Okay. It is October 15th, 2010. We are interviewing Mr. William Dudley of the New York Fed. Ms. Dudley, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. My name is Chris Seifer. I'm here with Greg Feldberg, Landon Strobel, and Joby Dan Gannon. We're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009. It tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis by the end of this year and put it in a report. That's why we thought it would make a lot of sense to talk to you, given your experience at the New York Fed. Before we get into the substance, as we talked a little bit about before we threw on the tape, could you please first just summarize your educational and work background, starting with college, please?
Okay, well, bachelor's from New College in Sarasota, Florida, PhD from University of California, Berkeley. Then I worked at the Board of Governors as an economist in the Research and Statistic Division. Then I went to work for J.P. Morgan as a regulatory economist. And then I went to work for Goldman Sachs, really more as a macro economist, you know, in the trading area, you know, supporting the trading operations of the firm. And then I came to the New York Fed in January 2nd, 2007. To run what's called the Markets Group and become the SOMA manager, which reports up to the FOMC. And then I did that till Mr. Geithner became Treasury Secretary and I became President of the bank.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. So let me just try to put some dates on those, though. New college degree in what year?
1974.
And then the PhD from Cal?
I think it was 82.
And then did you join the Board of Governors in 82?
81. I was at the Board of Governors from 81 to 83, and then I was at J.P. Morgan from 83 to 86, and Goldman Sachs from 86 to through the end of 06, and then the Fed beginning in 2007.
Right. Okay, great. Could you briefly describe what your job responsibilities were at the New York Fed prior to becoming president of the New York Fed?
I was running what's called the Markets Group. The Markets Group has some responsibility for a number of different things within the bank. One is monitoring market developments. Two is managing the Fed's portfolio of securities. Three is providing central bank services to foreign central banks who hold several trillion dollars of custody assets at the New York Fed. Four is running the discount window function for the New York Federal Reserve. Five is providing some treasury services to the U.S. Treasury, for example, treasury auction services. And six is implementing monetary policy and basically, you know, carrying out the you know, you think of the Markets Group as essentially the agent to carry out the instructions of the Federal Reserve Board with respect to monetary policy. So if they want something to happen on monetary policy, the Markets Group is sort of the instrument to make that so.
Okay. So in terms of monitoring market developments, could you provide us a little color on that? And in particular, I'm interested, since you got there in January of 07, of course, we saw the liquidity stresses that started to occur in 2007.
Well, we have a group that looks at and monitors markets and tries to keep the FOMC apprised of what's going on in market development. So at the beginning of every Federal Open Market Committee meeting, the SOMA manager, which is the head of the Markets Group, would brief the FOMC on you know, what's going on, and that could be, you know, very narrow. You know, in other words, why certain treasury securities are trading, you know, differently relative to each other, or it could be quite broad. It could be something where, you know, could be flagging, you know, developments in the subprime mortgage market, and so it's really, you know, that. So a lot of people are monitoring a lot of markets, and that's filled by the SOMA manager. And then that material is taken to the FOMC as part of the briefing that occurs before every at the beginning of every FOMC meeting.
Mm-hmm. And understanding the procedure of how things were communicated to the FOMC, could you sort of walk us through 2007 and what the issues were?
I don't have the briefings in front of me, so I can't really tell you exactly what I briefed on at each meeting. But you know, certainly subprime was one topic that came up, and obviously as the Bear Stearns issue unfolded, and that had pretty significant market repercussions, that would certainly be a topic of discussion.
What about, you know, in 2007? Of course, we start to see, you know, deterioration in the subprime market, and we see, you know, actually even going back into 06, you start to see a lot of failures of the, at least the smaller subprime originators. And then as you get further into 07, you know, things get worse with home prices continuing to deteriorate. And of course, by August of 07, at least one of the big things that happens is Countrywide has its liquidity run. Do you recall, you know, any, what were the monitoring of that situation of liquidity in general in 2007?
Well, I think that the Countrywide experience basically focused our attention on some of the structural issues with the tripartite repo system that I don't think we were fully appreciated before that. And, you know, that was in part the issue that the clearing banks themselves might be uncomfortable financing very large positions for the individual securities dealers, because if there was a risk that a firm could go bankrupt in the middle of the day, the clearing bank would be stuck with a very large amount of collateral that would have to liquidate. And as a consequence of that, the clearing bank itself might become uncomfortable with that exposure, or the clearing bank might respond to that discomfort by demanding more collateral from the counterparty. So that, so the Countrywide was sort of, I think, was important in sort of drawing out those particular issues.
Mm-hmm. I from other documents I've seen and interviews we've done, I don't remember the exact name because I've seen acronyms, but we've heard that there were like these CRMPG groups that were made up of industry executives and that periodically met with folks at the New York Fed and others on a range of topics, and one of those topics that we've heard about was the tri-party repo market, and that those meetings were going on in 2007. Does that jog any memory bells? Do you know anything about those?
I know that that there is this group that does sort of try to figure out how to sort of strengthen the financial market infrastructures and market practices, but I can't recall anything specific to the tripartite repo.
Okay, were you a member of any of those groups?
No, I don't believe I was in 2007. I don't believe I was part of those discussions.
Okay,
but I'm not absolutely certain.
Yeah, I mean, Chris, we weren't anticipating this, so we didn't pull the minutes and various documents that we gave you on CRMPG. And Theo, I know who you already spoke to, obviously, is more knowledgeable on some of those initiatives, at least because he's had his recollection refreshed.
Okay. And I understand that. I just want your best recollection. I understand you haven't had a chance to look at some documents. So when Countrywide goes down, and you said that, you know, it alerted us to some things you didn't fully appreciate before in terms of clearing banks wanting to take certain exposures, if you can you just provide us some more color about, you know, what was being discussed, what actions were taken as a result, what wasn't fully appreciated other than the clearing banks perhaps not being too comfortable with providing the intraday credit given the types of collateral and the level of haircuts.
I think actually, you know, the focus was really on, I think, a little bit more of a broader issue, which was the issue of the Federal Reserve could provide a lot of liquidity to the banks, but we couldn't necessarily ensure that the banks would necessarily on lend that liquidity to people that were non-banks. And so you can think of Countrywide as sort of, you know, an example of that. So there was a broader issue of how does the Fed Reserve, through its liquidity facility, support the broader financial system. And that work, you know, basically led to two sort of, prongs. One was to try to boost the liquidity provision to the banks themselves through the term auction facility, which was implemented, I think, in December 2007, at least announced in December 2007. And the second piece of that was the term securities lending facility that was really a device that actually allowed the Federal Reserve to provide liquidity directly to the securities firms by lending cash against their very high-quality securities holdings that they had. So I think that it was actually a much broader sort of set of issues, of which Countrywide was a specific, you know, issue. So I think our efforts were really more broadly based than just focused on the tripartite repo.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, of course, we know, you know, that after Bear, the PDCF gets set up too. Do you recall any discussions, you know, in the wake of Countrywide about, you know, a PDCF that was just a more direct providing of liquidity to investment banks?
What happened was that the term securities lending facility was, announced sort of in, I'm trying to remember the date exactly, several weeks before Bear Stearns weekend. It was a bit before the Bear Stearns weekend, and the development of it was really already, you know, it was being developed, but it wasn't yet operational. And then what happened on Bear Stearns weekend was a realization that the other securities firms could potentially have a very severe problem funding themselves on Monday, because the Bear Stearns event was going to be a big negative surprise to the markets. Because remember, Bear Stearns, the week before Bear Stearns weekend, the stock was trading on, you know, I don't remember exactly the number, maybe $60 a share or something. And then all of a sudden, a week later, there's a deal that's consummated at $2 a share. What happened was that weekend was, okay, how can we better backstop the tripartite repo system? Well, the best way we can do that is take the term securities lending facility and quickly adopt it to not just take lend cash against securities, on a borrowing basis, but on a more, or here's the cash. Because the way the term securities, I actually misspoke before, the way the term securities lending facility works, it's not cash for securities, it's treasuries for securities, and then the firms then take those treasury securities and then repo them out and obtain cash. So the difference between the term securities lending facilities is it's treasuries for securities that they turn into cash. The PDCF is cash lent against securities. And I think the only way we were able to do that so quickly on Bear Stearns weekend was because the term securities lending facility was already in the process of being stood up.
Mm-hmm.
So if that hadn't happened, it's not really obvious what we would have done Bear Stearns weekend.
Mm-hmm. So after Countrywide occurs and these programs are, well, actually before these programs are instituted, is the New York Fed, or the Fed in general, if you know, taking a look at the investment banks, for example? And the reason I ask is we know from documents and other interviews that after Bear Stearns, of course, you know, the New York Fed, I think, has on-site monitors at the four remaining investment banks because of the run on Bear's repos. But given the run on, I'm wondering if given the run on Countrywide's repos, if there was thought about, you know, increasing on-site monitoring, or I guess starting, you know, monitoring of the investment banks at that point.
Chris, just to get some, put some time frames here,
mm-hmm.
One thing, you mentioned the PDCF going, the on-site monitoring teams going into effect after Bear because of the run on Bear's repos. It was actually because we became a lender to those primary dealers that we put the on-site monitoring teams in. Now, that's March of 08. What
right.
time frame are you talking about when you say after Countrywide?
Well, the run on Countrywide was August of 07, so I'm talking that time
about
frame.
The period between August of 07 and March of 08?
Yes.
Just to give some clarity.
Yeah, we didn't have any statutory regulatory authority over the securities firms.
So we're obviously talking to the SEC about what's happening in that space. But beyond that, we don't have any statutory authority.
Okay, and in terms of talking to the SEC, what kind of information are you hearing from them about, you know, their about the investment bank's funding abilities?
Yeah, I was not part of those conversations, so I can't really shed any light on that.
Okay, that's fair. Understanding you weren't part of the conversations, just subsequently, do you have any knowledge about what was going on, either through, you know, discussions with others or reports you've seen since about what was going on in this August 2007 to March 2008 time frame?
Not really.
Okay.
Yeah, we haven't.
It's really not on my.
I understand. Okay, so let's move then to March 2008 and the institution of the PDCF, and because of that, the New York Fed looking at the investment banks since they are now a lender to these investment banks. I guess let's just start out generally. What was the purpose of the on-site monitoring?
We're creditors to these institutions, so we do care about their ability to fulfill their obligations. I mean, obviously we're collateralized, but just as the case of the discount window, it's not just you're not just looking at the collateral; you're also looking at the ability of the lender to be a viable institution. So we're looking at their liquidity practices and things of that nature. But again, that was not run out of the markets group. That's run out of the supervision area. So I'm not really the right person to talk to in terms of what the teams did precisely. And my understanding was it's very, very small team.
Okay. So maybe the way to approach this then is can you take us through, you know, generally what your role is from the March 2008 time frame to the September 2008 time frame, and I don't mean in terms of the five areas you talked about earlier, but really the areas we're interested in are, you know, the markets in general and then the condition of the various investment banks in general, since I will tell you, you know, we've seen in the documents and in interviews, you know, that there is an increased, it looks like, monitoring not only by you folks but by the SEC and others of the investment banks. We see in the documents, you know, a recognition of not only the volatility of the repo market to the investment banks, but the systemic importance of the tri-party repo market. Later on, we see recognition of you know, the importance of the OTC derivative market, and in particular the systemic importance of that. And in terms of Lehman, anyway, you know, we see very close monitoring of that investment bank, at least relative, I think, you know, to the other three. And, you know, we see various back and forth between New York Fed and DC Fed about how to deal with all of this, including, as I'm sure you're familiar with, at one point, I think in July, we see your email where you talk about a maiden lane type structure to help Lehman, if that might be a way to help out. In addition, we've seen documents where Pat Parkinson and others at the Fed are talking about the Fed stepping into the shoes of JPMC or Boney if they get squirrely and try to back out. So with that kind of long-winded introduction, can you walk us through the March to September 2008 time frame and your role and what the major concerns were?
Okay. Well, I think it's important to emphasize that my role is really more about liquidity provision and market monitoring rather than being institution specific. It's not really an institution specific role. So I'd be focused on things like what's going on in the interbank funding market, what's going on in terms of Europe, because we have foreign exchange swaps outstanding with Europe, so I spend a lot of time on that. I think that we were basically, monitoring how much stress there was in markets. We spent a lot of time on haircuts. What kind of haircuts were people charging hedge funds, in terms of to borrow, you know, what kind of conditions were there in terms of the lending market between securities firms and their customers. Very focused on, you know, the transparency into the assets that individual institutions held and their valuation. Certainly spent a fair amount of time trying to make sure we understood the CDO market and what the implications were of the lack of transparency into the collateralized, you know, debt obligation market. But it wasn't, you know, wasn't a firm specific kind of approach. With one exception, the one exception where we were very firm specific is we very very much monitored the primary dealer activity of some of the primary dealers that were weak or didn't have strong parents. As part of our open market operations, we do transactions with the primary dealers. There's roughly 20 primary dealers today, and you know, during the crisis, there were a couple primary dealers that were either very weak, like Countrywide, or were not really very deeply under the regulatory safety net, which like Cantor Fitzgerald. So in terms of institution-specific things, I think our focus is more on that, because the primary dealers are really the interface by how the Federal Reserve manages its portfolio and the reserves in the banking system. So the institution stuff was more on that.
Okay, so then let's talk about the more market liquidity and market monitoring type stuff. What were the what were the main concerns and areas that your group and the New York Fed were looking at?
Well, we're trying to get a sense of how much what the liquidity pressures in the market were. LIBOR times minus OIS is a classic spread. LIBOR OIS spread. OIS is essentially what the market thinks the federal funds rate is going to be. So, that spread in normal times would be in the 5 to 10 basis points range, and it widened pretty dramatically in the fall of 2008, and then came down a bit as we went into 2007, and as we came into the summer of 2008. And that is something that we're very much focused on. We're very interested in how our liquidity facilities were affecting market function. Because one thing we're trying to understand is are what we offering actually having the desired consequence. And if I remember right, what happened is things actually sort of improved as we went from March to the summer, into the summer of 2008. And then, of course, then we ran into the whole issue with Fannie and Freddie Mac, which I think was sort of the trigger that caused the things to start to unwind as we went into the late summer.
Okay. Hold on one sec. Okay. What about, you had mentioned too, in terms of looking at the markets, or I think it was in terms of the markets, the transparency of the assets that the institutions held. So I guess maybe that's not the markets, but could you provide some more, and you had mentioned the CDO market and the lack of transparency. Could you provide a little more color on what the concerns were there?
Well, I think the concerns were just that if people didn't know what the assets, if people couldn't value the assets, then that created uncertainty about whether the firms were, what the firms, the solvency of the firms, and if there were questions about the solvency of the firms, that could potentially lead to a liquidity problem. And, I think there was, some concern that lack of transparency itself could actually contribute to a liquidity problem arising sooner than if there had been a lot more transparency in terms of what these assets were. One interesting thing that came up during the crisis, of course, was that the same assets seemed to be valued differently at different firms. So that was a sort of a classic, example of, well, how can I really trust, the balance sheets, how the firms represent their balance sheets if the same asset can be valued differently at different firms. But from my perspective, it was all about, the risk of a liquidity problem caused by the lack of transparency.
Did you or any of your direct reports or folks working for you in this time frame, were you having discussions with folks that were providing the repo financing or commercial paper financing that were telling you, look, it's one thing to finance treasuries and agencies, and frankly, when you got later in the year, maybe even agencies was an issue. But there's an increasing amount of collateral that's not agencies and treasuries, and we are uncomfortable financing that.
We were certainly aware of those concerns, and we were talking to a pretty broad set of players in the market. And one of the things I did when I came in to hit up the markets group was try to broaden the set of institutions that we talked to, and to include people on the buy side. So the money market mutual funds, hedge funds, other players on the buy side, so we sort of could have a better understanding of both sides of the market. And of course, as we went into the crisis, that became even more important. So we're definitely having those kinds of conversations.
So help me understand a little bit more in those conversations, and let me tell you why. In some of the previous work we've done, looking at the issue of too big to fail, and in particular in the context of Lehman, we saw short-term funding counterparties definitely being more concerned with Lehman. And perhaps shortening tenors and requiring higher haircuts, but they were still willing to lend. They were still rolling the repos or rolling the commercial papers. So what were you hearing from the various market participants that you were talking to?
Well, I think our perception was that the primary dealer credit facility was very, very important as a backstop to tripartite repo. One reason that they were willing to lend is that they knew that as long as the firms had good collateral, that if they weren't lending, that the firm always had the option of going to the Fed and borrowing. And so that backstop lending, even if we weren't lending very much money to the firms, it's that backstop capacity to be able to lend, to provide liquidity, basically that kept them in the game. They felt comfortable continuing to lend. So we feel that the primary dealer presence was a very important aspect of why they were willing to continue to participate.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the documents that the New York Fed has produced to us is a June 2008 email that you wrote, I think, to Bernanke and others, where you made a similar point that the fact that the iBanks weren't actually drawing on the PDCF, amounts didn't matter. What mattered was that it was there as a backstop. And I think, I don't have it in front of me, but I think he even said that it may have made the difference between whether or not Lehman survived. Were market participants telling you that the PDCF provided them additional comfort?
I don't know that I actually had that explicit conversation, but let's put it this way: that was my conclusion.
Let me ask you this. Another thing that at least the folks here have talked about is whether the PDCF, provided comfort to Boney and J.P. Morgan Chase's, the clearing banks, because on the one hand, I can see it providing them comfort on, look, if there's not an investor at the end of the day, that the dealer can draw on the PDCF, but I don't see how it necessarily provides comfort if, God forbid, there's a failure during the day, because then the clearing bank gets stuck, holding the collateral. Were you having any discussions, or your people having any discussions with either Boney or J.P. Morgan Chase about whether or not, the PDCF provided them comfort, or whether they wanted, sort of like a super-duper PDCF, where, sort of what we've seen in some emails with Pat Parkinson about, the Fed being willing to step into their shoes if there was an intraday default?
I don't really remember, to be honest, but I would suspect that they got comfort from the PDCF too, because if the firm can obtain liquidity, if the firm has sufficient collateral to be obtained liquidity, then there's probably not going to be a solvency problem, given that the regulatory because the solvency is going to be driven by their regulatory capital ratios, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have liquidity, you're not going to be insolvent as long as you have sufficient regulatory capital.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I wouldn't think that would have been a big concern to J.P. Morgan and Boney, but you'd have to ask them.
Right, and I probably will. But did you ever hear, you know, at any time, you know, prior to September 2008 that either Boney or J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, was considering or threatening not to unwind the repos?
I don't remember anything like that. I mean, look, we under
September, prior to September, you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that.
Okay. Well, and the reason I said before September is because I explicitly wanted to then ask you, what about in September, and particularly over Lehman weekend?
Well, I don't. For me, the Lehman weekend, I don't remember having conversations with J.P. Morgan Chase that we're talking about here.
Uh-huh.
I do remember having conversations with them subsequently on Monday and Tuesday about that issue because we wanted to be able to keep the U.S. broker dealer in business so it could be liquidated in an orderly way, and for that to happen, J.P. Morgan had to be willing to continue to participate and let the tripartite repo market continue to fund them. So there definitely were conversations on, you know, Monday and Tuesday of the following week, I believe, on that issue. I don't remember it actually happening during the weekend itself.
Okay. I believe that the Sunday night before the Lehman bankruptcy, the Fed expanded the types of collateral eligible for the PDCF. Do you know the genesis behind that?
Well, I think the issue was that we want to be prepared for the worst case if Lehman were to fail, and we wanted the market participants to feel that the PDCF was a complete backstop for the tripartite repo system rather than an approximate backstop. You know, the terms of the PDCF were essentially liberalized so that the PDCF became essentially equivalent. Could take down the whole tripartite repo system if necessary. Before, the backstop was, you know, pretty broad, but incomplete, and so that's really the logic of that.
Mm-hmm. And understanding you had some before we get to the conversations you had with J.P. Morgan Chase, after Lehman declares bankruptcy, we've heard anyway that from some other folks that. During Lehman weekend, you know, J.P. Morgan folk were saying, if you don't expand the PDCF, we're not going to be willing to unwind Lehman's repos on Monday. Are you aware of that or have any conversations with folks about that during the weekend?
I don't recall anything like that.
Okay. So then after J.P. Morgan, after Lehman files for bankruptcy, you mentioned you had conversations about the PDCF with them afterwards. Can you just give us some color on what those conversations were?
Yeah, I'd have to go back and sort of refresh my memory, but I think it was just that we wanted them to, you know, keep doing business so that the U.S. broker dealer can be wound down in an orderly way.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, I think you have a bunch of emails that
right.
go into the discussions that were going on. Then I'm
they took place. I just don't remember all the specifics.
Right, and I'm not sure if you were actually on most of those emails. I mean, you may have been copied on some.
Yeah,
of them.
Sure.
I was aware these conversations were taking place.
Okay. And generally, what kind of impact did you see on? So once Lehman goes down, and of course Merrill. Announces the deal with B of A, you've got Morgan and Goldman Sachs left. What kind of impact, if any, did you see on their funding after Lehman weekend, I guess as we'll term it?
I don't remember precisely what happened in terms of their funding, but I was definitely concerned about their well-being. And I remember having some conversations with President Geithner about you know, what should we do about them? And you know, my preferred approach was the one we actually ended up following, which was have them become bank holding companies. And as part of that, I was very much pushing the view that not only did they need to become bank holding companies, they needed to, after they did that, to demonstrate market access and go out and actually raise equity to show that investors view them as viable as bank holding companies. So I felt that there needed to be a two-part process. One, they become bank holding companies so that they're much more within the safety net. And two, demonstrate that their business model is still viable by going out and actually raising equity capital. And that's what happened. Goldman raised capital from Warren Buffett, and Morgan Stanley raised capital from Mitsubishi.
Mm-hmm. And did once, I think we've seen in documents or through interviews that even after Goldman and Morgan became bank holding companies the following weekend, that Morgan was, at least Morgan, I don't know about Goldman yet because I haven't seen the documents or talked to the folks that have, but Morgan was still having some funding issues. Do you recall anything about that?
Yeah, I think they were still having funding issues.
And, do you...
In part because the Mitsubishi money didn't appear immediately. There was an agreement for them to supply the funds, but that didn't actually close right away. I can't remember exactly how long the lag was, but it was a week or two lag, and so markets were still unsettled because they weren't really sure whether Morgan Stanley was actually going to get the equity investment from Mitsubishi.
So when did you see the markets settle, at least for Morgan, and what did you see as why it settled?
I think it actually took quite a while because if you remember, there's a much broader problem going on at the same time. I mean, the U.S. commercial paper market is very dysfunctional as well. So it's there's runs on money market mutual funds. The focus wasn't just on Morgan Stanley. The focus was really on how do we get the broad U.S. money markets function. How do we stop the run on the money market mutual funds and get the commercial paper market back to functioning properly? So I think, yes, there were definitely we're concerned about Morgan Stanley being able to obtain sufficient funding. But remember, they have the ability now to take their collateral to the PDCF. So as long as they have sufficient collateral, then they should be able to obtain sufficient funding. So I think the focus, from my perspective, really turned to the more broader issue of how do we actually deal with the problem that U.S. money markets are not working properly.
Mm-hmm. And understanding that, I mean, I understand you may not know the specifics on Morgan or Goldman, but like I said, we've seen documents that indicate even after they become bank holding companies, and I guess even after at least it's announced that the capital raise with Mitsubishi, there's still funding issues. And I don't know, I'm just trying to get...
But I guess my point is everybody was... funding issues were the norm as opposed to the exception at that time.
Right.
That's really my point. If you were in a commercial bank, and remember, even though they're now bank holding companies, the part of the entity that's a commercial bank and can actually borrow from the discount window is a very small piece of the total entity. So bringing them over as bank holding companies does not allow them to have full access to the discount window. It just allows the bank piece to have access to the discount window. So anybody who wasn't a commercial bank at that time was going to have pretty significant funding issues. That was very broadly based. That wasn't just Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs. And so that's really, I want to put that in the right context of what was really happening at the time.
So when did the norm become the exception then? When did things settle down?
It was really the money market funds that were engendered by the reserve fund breaking the buck, and then that caused the commercial paper market to start to become very dysfunctional very, very quickly. I think it was I can't remember.
It was overnight, right?
Yeah, it was days, yeah.
Days. And then, it took us some time to develop the commercial paper funding facility, but that was, our response to try to provide the same kind of liquidity backstop for commercial paper that we had done for tripartite repo. And then we stood that up, I think, late October. Maybe it was a little earlier than that, but sometime in October we stood that up. And then once that got, and the other thing that we did, of course, was we went to unlimited foreign exchange swaps with Europe, which was very, very important. European banks in particular were having huge difficulties. And the reason why they're having huge difficulties is that they have a book of dollar-based assets. They're long dollar-based assets, but they're short dollar funding, and so they have to basically obtain the funding from New York. And in, you know, in the crisis, the willingness of U.S. banks, who are under their own, you know, set of strains in terms of liquidity, are very reluctant to extend liquidity to the European banks. And so we basically took the foreign exchange swaps that were already in place and opened them up in terms of magnitude. We made them fixed price auctions so that people could get as much dollar liquidity through the foreign exchange swaps as was on demand, as that was needed. So there was a whole bunch of different things done to try to ease the liquidity problems that were in the market. Morgan Stanley had their issues, but I really would say that's like that was almost like the least of our, I wouldn't say it was the least of our worries, but we had a lot of other worries at the same time.
So understanding that the commercial paper and foreign exchange programs that you folks put in place, I think you said in October, was October, you know, the time when things started to settle down?
I think they started to settle. They started to improve at the end of October as we went into November, as people gained confidence in the commercial paper backstop working. But you know, it's a gradual process. I don't remember us going from, you know, red light to green light, you know, quickly. It was sort of a gradual grind and improving. Now, because remember, the other thing that's going on at the time now is that the global economy, is also now starting to deteriorate very, very sharply. One of the consequences of this locking up of the funding markets was that trade finance completely dried up, and so there's a huge collapse in trade activity, which basically communicated the economic shock globally. So at the same time, we did not return to health very quickly because the economic situation was deteriorating very, very sharply as we're going through the first quarter and into the first quarter of 2009. And you know, there were all the concerns about the banks' ability, you know, solvency, you know, which then led to the TARP program and the preferred stock investment by the government into the commercial bank. So this was a very broad problem by the time we got to the fall of 2008. It wasn't just about, you know, individual securities markets. It was about, you know, financial markets broadly speaking and now the economy broadly speaking.
I'm so confused about it.
Yeah, because up until the fall of 2008, the economy was growing. Maybe not very fast, but it was sort of going sideways. And then it was really after the Lehman failure that the economy really turned down very, very sharply, not just in the U.S., but globally.
This is Greg Feldberg. I guess you had said that they had wanted to get access to the discount window. I guess explain why the PDCF and the TSLF access wasn't enough and why that's an order of magnitude different when it comes to liquidity.
You mean the
once you become a bank holding company in the case.
Now remember the TSLF and the PDCF are 13-3 facilities, so they're only allowed to be extended under unusual and exigent circumstances. So it's by no means a permanent solution. The discount window is open to depository institutions as a standing facility. There's no special determination that has to be made by the Board of Governors in extremis. So everyone, you know, when you're looking at the PDCF and TSLF, everyone knows that that's temporary, not permanent.
Mm-hmm. President Dudley, this is Landon Strobel. You mentioned that the TAF was part of a two-pronged approach to address liquidity constraints in the broader financial system. How did the TAF do this more effectively than the discount window?
The discount window, the problem with the discount window is the discount window, people don't like to use it because they view it as there's a risk that they will be viewed as weak by using it. Now, we don't disclose who uses the discount window, although under the Dodd-Frank legislation with a two-year lag, we will have to disclose who borrows from the discount window. So it's not that we disclose them, but they're still worried that it will come out because journalists will ask them. They'll see that borrowings in the Fifth District went up dramatically this week. There's only two large banks in that district. They'll start asking those banks to borrow from the discount window. So people are very reluctant to go to the discount window because it's stigmatized. the TAF, the terms auction facility, avoids some of that stigma because many people are participating at the same time. And when you're borrowing from the TAF, it's not because you need the liquidity immediately. You're bidding in the auction on a Monday or Tuesday for settlement on, I think it was Thursday, a couple day lag. So clearly you're not desperate for liquidity. So the fact that it's an auction, there's many participants, and the auction timing is ahead of when the liquidity is actually provided, seem to reduce a lot of the stigma issues that we had with the discount window. And so the TAF actually seemed to solve the stigma problem for us and work pretty well in providing, getting the banks to be actually willing to take advantage of the facilities that we had on offer. But, you know, functionally, the TAF is really not really any different than the discount window in the sense of the collateral that's actually, you know, that we lend against. It's the same kind of collateral.
So you had said that the period after March, after things settled down, was quiet for a while until Fannie and Freddie. So I guess I just had two follow-up questions. One is, how do you, what signs were you looking at? What seemed more calm? And the second question is, you know, what were the signs about Fannie and Freddie? What were their liquidity problems in particular that surfaced?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we were looking at a whole variety of things, but like one thing we were looking at through this whole period was how are markets trading with each other. And there were periods when people were very risk averse and the markets traded in very highly correlated ways. And then when things calmed down, we started to see markets behave in a less correlated way, which was a sign that, you know, risk appetites were returning and things were subsiding. LIBOR OIS spread was another example. We were certainly watching the credit default swap market to see, what people were doing in terms of assessing what the counterparty risk was of large financial institutions. So there's a whole variety of things that we're looking at.
Okay, and then
in terms of Fannie and Freddie, I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, obviously they're major financial institutions that backstop a large, important market, the agency MBS market, and they're also very active in the market directly through the agency debt market. So obviously, to the extent that people start worrying about them, that obviously has pretty significant implications for the broader economy potentially. So, you know, when they start to run into difficulties, that was important to us. And I think, you know, if you remember the intervention for Fannie and Freddie really took two parts. I can't remember the details right now about what the first part was, but I do remember thinking that first part was not going to be sufficient.
I mean, was the question about Fannie and Freddie a liquidity question as much as, obviously everybody was talking about the solvency question, but was
it? I think it was liquidity because of questions about solvency. I mean, I think we view the two are always very linked. If you're clearly solvent, you're generally not going to have a liquidity problem. But if there are questions about your solvency arise, then liquidity problems are likely to arise, you know, fairly quickly.
Okay. To what extent was the OTC derivatives market on your dashboard? I mean, I think after Bear, we have some evidence that the Fed was talking about that as a source of systemic risk.
It wasn't really on my, dashboard directly. There was a lot of work underway at the bank on OTC derivatives to try to, you know, the big thing that President Geithner had done was to try to get the banks to really clean up their backlogs in terms of OTC derivatives. So there's a lot of work underway to try to improve the market function. I wasn't really involved in that to any meaningful degree.
Okay.
Just one more follow-up question on the TAF. So was there any intention to address the shadow banking system through commercial banking channels with the TAF?
Well, I mean, I think we historically the Federal Reserve has always tended to supply liquidity to the banks with the idea that liquidity provided to the banking system then can be on-lent to solvent institutions in the non-bank sector. What we saw in this crisis was that didn't always take place to the extent that it had in the past. Now, obviously, the shadow banking system was really a big part of this crisis. I don't think you know, I don't think people going in really had a full understanding of the complexity of the shadow banking system, the role of SIBs and conduits, the backstops that banks were providing to the SIB and conduits, either explicitly or implicitly. So I think there are a lot of things there that we didn't fully understand.
You mentioned that, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but something to the effect of that the TSLF was a reaction to the events seen in the fall of 2007. Is that correct?
No, I think the TSLF was more a view that the liquidity that we were providing to the banks through the TAF was not leading to a significant diminishment of financing pressures elsewhere. So it was a question, okay, so maybe we should think about bypassing the banking system and trying to come up with a vehicle that provide liquidity support to the primary dealer community more directly.
So this was, the plans for this were in place well before there were any clear problems with Bear Stearns.
Yeah, this was under development for quite some time, and you know, it was announced a week or two before the Bear Stearns weekend. We didn't do this because we thought Bear Stearns was going to get in trouble.
So it was pure coincidence then that the TSLF was launched very close in proximity to Bear Stearns.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's coincidence. I would say generally it's coincidence, but the reasons why we were thinking about doing the TSLF were consistent with some of the same reasons of why Bear Stearns got in trouble. So, you know, if the world had been a really wonderful place, there would have been no TSLF, and Bear Stearns would have been, you know, fine. So I would say that the two are not tied together, but the same environmental factors that led to Bear Stearns were environmental factors that informed the TSLF.
I see. So if the problem that we witnessed with the countrywide run, where perhaps their clearing bank wasn't willing to unwind intraday, how was that addressed up until the PDCF, or was TSLF partially to address that as well?
I don't know that the TSLF was done really with that in mind. That was not my. I'd have to go back and sort of refresh my memory on that. But I thought my memory of the TSLF was really more a way of providing liquidity to the securities dealers, not specific to the tripartite repo market. I think it was really only as Bear Stearns weekend that the importance of backstopping the tripartite repo market became very clear.
I see. So you'd mentioned that there were some structural frailties that came to light from the countrywide episode, but up until the Bear Stearns episode,
I don't think. I think that was the first inkling. I would say, I wouldn't say that the countrywide episode revealed all the potential instabilities of the tripartite repro system. With the benefit of hindsight, that first. That's sort of one of the first pieces of evidence. Now, whether we had yet put all the pieces together to understand exactly how, all the sources of vulnerability, I don't think we fully yet have put all the pieces together.
I see. Okay, that's very helpful.
With the benefit of hindsight, you can point to what was the first, key point. But as you're following the train, in time, that first key point you may note it and it may get your attention, but it might not be so significant to you that you necessarily are going to set the train a whole series of responses.
So can you help us understand what?
I can't remember with countrywide. In the end of the day, it was satisfied by countrywide. I believe giving the negotiation between the clearing bank and countrywide with how much collateral that countrywide was going to provide to the clearing bank, and so it was over.
I see.
It wasn't like the countrywide clearing bank thing had any great broad consequence. It was just a disagreement that was settled in a way that things went on as before.
Can you help us understand what would happen if there were a major dealer bankruptcy intraday?
Well, if there was a major dealer bankruptcy intraday, the clearing bank, my understanding, and we have a bunch of lawyers here that can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the clearing bank would be stuck with the collateral that was basically backstopping the intraday overdraft that covers the unwind of the tripartite repo from the morning to the evening. So, you know, to the extent that a dealer has a $100 billion tripartite repo position that they unwind at the end of the day, the clearing bank would now have a $100 billion loan to that entity that's now bankrupt, secured by that collateral.
So then would the clearing bank look to finance all those assets, or would they look to liquidate them? And if they did try to finance them, what options would they have?
I don't know. I mean, we never, got that far. I mean, I think that, obviously in extremis, we have to sort of see, we'd have to see what would happen. But it would be shocking if, they asked to come to the discount window with their collateral, and I think we would probably be pretty open to financing the collateral and get the discount window. That's what the discount window is for. But that's sort of a hypothetical.
Is it possible that you could end up in a situation where there's a loss of confidence in the clearing bank?
Only if the collateral were considered, very dodgy.
And I had no place to bring it.
And they had no place to find it. So, I mean, I think, if you thought that the collateral was worth, only if the people thought the collateral was worth, significantly less than the value of the loan, and I don't think that was a big risk.
Looking back, was there any way of knowing, or I should just say simply, with hindsight, the full benefit of hindsight, was it a mistake that the investment banks were so dependent on the repo market for their financing? And looking back, how did that develop that we thought that this would be okay?
Well, it's one of those things where everyone is confident the market works very smoothly, and then when people become unconfident, then it works much less well. So during the period when it's confident, the problem is sort of late; it's not apparent. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that there were some problems in the tripartite repo market that were revealed by the crisis. In fact, we are in the process of, we have a whole initiative underway to address the whole unwind issue to solve this clearing bank problem, which is basically underway. So we are in the process, we think, of basically largely mitigating this unwind problem. Clearing banks. The clearing banks won't ever be in this position where they have huge amounts of collateral financed against tripartite repo.
Mm-hmm. What are the biggest problems with the repo market? Is it simply that non-traditional collateral was allowed? I mean, is it that simple?
Well, I think it's two things. It's one that the standards of what the lenders were willing to lend against lower and lower quality collateral. So, the lenders are willing to do these transactions freely. They're willing to give a dollar against a dollar, 10 cents of collateral that may not be very high quality or very liquid.
Gary Cohen.
That's one issue.
So I guess let me just from where we were. I think we were talking about the two things about the repo market, and you had mentioned you started to talk about the collateral.
They were willing to lend money against the collateral that was probably increasingly of lower quality, or at least harder to value, less liquid over time. This happens just sort of gradually over time. And the second problem, of course, is that, and this problem still exists to this day, and something that we still don't have a perfect solution for, is that at the first time sign of trouble, these investors in tripartite repo tend to run rather than take the collateral that they've lent against. In other words, the choice is I can just withdraw from the market or stay in the market, take my chances, and if the entity were to fail, I get stuck with the high-quality collateral. They'll run even if the collateral is high quality. So high-quality collateral itself is not sufficient when an institution gets in trouble to keep the end investors in the market.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the regulation, I mean, how was the repo market regulated before this crisis? And were there actually regulations in place that might have helped?
I don't think that there was a formal regulatory process for the tripartite repo market that I'm aware of. An over-the-counter, I'd say it was largely unregulated. Yeah, the end borrowers were regulated, but remember this is investors freely entering into loans with firms. I don't think that there was there wasn't really oversight of. I mean, I guess some of the investors had some oversight from the SEC, but it was very lightly regulated.
Mm-hmm. Two regulations that haven't mentioned to us, which we're trying to figure out how much to weight. One is that the Fed has the regulation TMU on margin loans, but I guess that was at one point exempted for broker dealers, and I'm wondering whether that's a relevant kind of deregulatory measure to the repo market, or if it's just irrelevant.
Yeah, I don't think that's Mr. Dudley's.
Time my comparative advantage.
Okay, we'll try that with a legal person.
There are legal people who could answer that better, but not the ones that are sitting around this table. We have our regulation experts. If you want regulation T and U, I know who to point you to, but
okay.
People sitting here.
Okay.
So did the Fed have any contingency plans for the failure of a major clearing bank? At least with respect to the tri-party repo market?
We would, the discount window is open to lend freely to those entities, but obviously, with Dodd-Frank now there's a resolution regime in place for the, the banks. There's always been a resolution regime in place for them, so presumably they would go into a bridge bank kind of a relationship at the FDIC if they refuse. It's hard to know what would actually happen, but it's not really the resolution of a bank is. If that failed, it's not really our issue, I think.
But what would happen to the tri-party repo market under those circumstances?
I think it really depends on how the bank was resolved. I mean, if there was a bridge bank, which I think that, for a very large bank, it's highly likely that there'd be a bridge bank, presumably the clearing bank function would be, kept in place, I would imagine.
Okay, let's... Now try to go a little bit more big picture, and Shari, we'll go to some of the stuff on the list. So, Mr. Dudley, let's go to probably the biggest picture question that we've been asking folks, and that is just generally, in your opinion, what were the primary causes of the financial crisis?
Well, we got a couple hours.
I do if you do.
I think there are multiple causes, and we'd be happy to send you some speeches that I've given on the subject. I've given a bunch of different speeches on the lessons of the crisis and the causes. I mean, I think that one, really, really sloppy underwriting practices for residential mortgages were very, very important. Two, lack of transparency in terms of ability to value, complex derivative obligations and other illiquid assets on the balance sheets of banks and security dealers was really important. Bad incentives in the system so that, the trader's option where, you get paid based on your fiscal year results, which may be based in part on mark-to-market outcomes, and then if the assets go down in value the subsequent year, there's no clawback, so that encourages a lot of risk-taking. Fourth, probably not very good risk management practices among some firms that basically, didn't fully appreciate the risk that they were taking in their trading books, especially through their AAA CDO exposures. So I think there are a lot of different elements to this. The exposure of the banks to the shadow banking system, the SIBs, the conduits, fragility, in the municipal finance market, for these auction rate securities. There's just a whole, there's a whole host of things that you have to point to. The interconnectedness of the system, so where shocks in one area reverberate, the reluctance of banks to cut dividends to conserve capital because that'll signal that they're weak. The level and quality of bank capital, If you go back and look at the, the amount of common equity capital that the banks actually had on their books, pretty small, especially in certain jurisdictions. So I think it's not one thing. I think it's many, many, many different things all coming together, interacting in a complex way. And I think that's why it was hard for people to really foresee the crisis coming, because there was not one thing, there were many things. But I think if we had one thing to do over again, I think if we had had much better underwriting practices for residential mortgages, that would have gone a long way to make the crisis less severe, because housing prices would have gone up a lot less, housing prices would have come down a lot less, there would be a lot less toxic assets floating through the system, CDOs, written on subprime, synthetic CDOs. So there would have been a lot less losses that were borne by large financial institutions. So if you could have just avoided that one thing, I think we still would have had a lot of these other residual problems, but the crisis would have been much, much severe as a consequence. So that's the thing I would sort of put as number one.
Okay. And understanding that one, let's talk about that a little, the sloppy underwriting practices. Obviously, on the one hand, the underwriters are the ones doing those sloppy underwriting practices, but we've also got regulators out there that are presumably either know and allowing about the underwriting practices, or perhaps even worse, don't know, but I suspect they knew. Any opinions on, relative culpability, in terms of, the actual underwriters and the regulators responsible for supervising these shops?
I mean, it's hard to know how to sort of hand out responsibility. I mean, I think part of the problem is that during the boom, all of these assets looked like they were performing very well, because as long as credit is freely available and home prices are going up, there are very low credit losses on all these obligations. So, the boom itself sort of basically created a set of circumstances where it basically created a false impression as to the safety of all these obligations and instruments. And so, I don't want to give a free pass to the regulators or the underwriters or the investors, because I think they all deserve, some responsibility. But, one could imagine why people got fooled during the boom, because the boom basically allowed all the subprime borrowers were getting into these homes on very dodgy terms to refinance their mortgages or sell their homes in a way that didn't cause any, cause very, very low losses during this period.
So you mentioned the this is Greg Feldberg again. You mentioned the interconnectedness of the system, and we've talked a lot about that, but I guess just if you could just help us in your, just how would you define that, and how would you weight the different types of connections for us?
Well, I mean, I think that, what we saw in the crisis is that there was, not just an elaborate banking system, there was a pretty, very elaborate shadow banking system that lay just outside the banking system, supported by the banking system through liquidity backstops and other, implicit support. And I don't think I don't think people fully understood, that those, implicit supports were actually going to turn into more explicit commitments. So there was going to be a lot more strain on the banking system as these things sort of unwound. And I don't think people fully appreciated the fragility of some of these shadow banking entities. These were entities that were basically financing long-term illiquid assets short-term, which was fine during the boom because the assets were of very high quality, and so people were very comfortable doing that. But as soon as the assets started to turn down in quality, then people started to pull back in terms of their funding, and then that sort of pushed these entities back towards the banking system. So that's sort of how the ripple effects sort of spread pretty broadly.
Okay, so you're largely talking about asset-backed commercial paper programs?
I'm talking about asset-backed commercial paper. Yeah, I'm talking about, but it's broader than that. I mean, auction-rate securities market is basically supported by the liquidity puts that banks provide. So there's lots of different, what we saw was there are a lot of different liquidity puts embedded in the system that the banking system sort of ultimately backstops. you know, the interconnectedness between Europe and the U.S. in terms of the dollar liquidity shortfall that the European banks had funded by the U.S. banks, you know, is another good example of interconnectedness.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the way that our housing market issues infected their banks and their funding markets. So that's a good example of interconnectedness.
Mm-hmm. When it came to the
dollar liquidity shortfall problem, turned out to be, you know, not just European, but it also popped up in some other places around the world.
So, what is the concern there for the U.S. markets if the European banks can't get dollars? What's the feedback loop?
Well, the feedback loop is the U.S. are hugely big counterparties to those European banks, and if those European banks were to fail because of the result of their inability to obtain dollar liquidity, then that would lead to significant, you know, exposures for the U.S. banking system. And this is not something that the ECB can do. They can't provide dollar liquidity to their banks. The Federal Reserve is the only entity that can create dollar liquidity. So, this is material to, you know, the health of not just the European bank, but also the U.S. banks, who are their major counterparties.
Great.
Okay, let me ask you a couple of other things. Of the nine or so things that you listed in terms of causes of the financial crisis, a couple things you didn't mention that's in our statute that tells us to look at, that I wanted to ask you about, given your background as an economist, was just the role, two things that at least I see as related, is the role of low interest rates throughout the decade of the 2000s, or relatively low anyway, and then the flow of foreign money into the U.S. Any opinions on that?
I mean, certainly people have written about that as factors. You know, I'm not going to debate whether they were factors or not. I just view them as sort of secondary order factors. In other words, if we'd done all the other things right, they would have been very unimportant in this. So I'm not going to debate whether they're factors or not. I mean, I put them as second order. So think of my nine as first order factors.
Okay. And then, again, going back to the sloppy underwriting standards, related question that we are somewhat struggling with is why sloppy underwriting standards? Do you have any opinions on whether that is driven by, demand by consumers for the loan product, or originators, providing that product because of demand from the street?
I think there's a whole bunch of reasons why it happened. I mean, basically it happened because you could basically take a mortgage that wasn't very well underwritten and turn a pool of those mortgages into mostly AAA rated securities, that there was a lot of demand for end investors for those AAA rated securities. So, it's that ability to perform that alchemy of turning what's not a very high quality asset into something that's mostly that most of it pops out as a triple rated entity that there's investor demand for, that's probably critical to this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is based on a very strong belief that the performance of these underlying assets, so let's just use the example of subprime mortgages, that the performance of these subprime mortgages is uncorrelated or not highly correlated.
Right.
So as long as it's not highly correlated, then you can actually have quite significant losses, in some of the subprime mortgages, but the AAA assets will perform well because they're at the top of the water. You know, they get paid off first.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem, of course, is when the correlation assumptions that's embedded in these collateralized debt obligations turns out to be wrong, and that's really the fundamental problem that the rating agencies made. Is they assumed that the correlations were going to be, low, as they have been historically, when in fact the correlations went to become very, very high. If the correlation is one, tranching the securities has no benefit whatsoever. And so as the correlations went up, the fallacy of the collateralized debt obligations was shown to be, you know, very suspect. And of course, the other problem was, of course, just the, how you valued what these things are worth, you know, based on the value of the underlying collateral. I think the presumption was that the AAA were so good, so far away from the potential losses at the bottom of the capital stack, that you didn't really need to be able to value the individual assets very well. I remember asking someone in the spring of 2008 how long would it take to value a particular CDO, and the dealer said it would take us 3 weeks to actually value what it was worth by going through the underlying assets. So that lack of transparency in terms of what, you know, how to actually go from the assets to the security was also a huge problem.
Another thing we've been looking at is the whole issue of too big to fail. And one of the things we've seen is that you know, there seems to be a common fact pattern where you've got institutions that, you know, grow with short-term funding sources and at some point end up with illiquid and difficult-to-value assets that, as we've talked about, tends to trigger a liquidity run at some point. But one of the differences we've seen in the decade of the 2000s is that while that pattern was also occurring, the banks got, and the investment banks, got a whole lot larger than they were in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Any discussions? I mean, I know you're not at the New York Fed until 07, but do you know if there were any discussions within the New York Fed about, you know, the much bigger size and interconnectedness of these institutions and whether or not that was a concern?
I wasn't part of any of those discussions. I don't recall any discussions of that type.
Any understanding, not just any opinions about, you know, the well, quote unquote too big to fail issue?
I think the too big to fail issue is a little bit overrated in the sense that if people perceive these entities truly too big to fail, then why did they run? I mean, we saw lots of flight from lots of big institutions. That now people are saying in retrospect were too big to fail. Now maybe ex post they turned out to be too big to fail, but ex ante I don't think people were ever, you know, certain that these entities were too big to fail. So my own personal opinion is that the moral hazard problems induced by too big to fail are a little bit overrated, because we actually see people pulling away from even very large institutions in time of crisis.
Mm-hmm. What about this is another thing on the sheet that we sent. You know, one thing we've been looking at is the fact that, you know, the financial sector contributing a larger and larger percentage of GDP. And any opinion on that?
I have made the same observation before while I was at Goldman Sachs, and I thought it was, you know, I remember thinking this is sort of odd. I didn't really go much farther than that, because I mean, I guess my feeling was, why as technology, you know, proliferates and get more efficient at, you know, doing things, why would the financial share of GDP increase? So I found it a little bit you know, hard to understand.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think the story at the time was that the financial sector was getting much more adept at distributing risk and allowing people to alter their balance sheets in a way that they could lay off the kind of risk that they didn't want to take and keep on their balance sheet the risk that they wanted to take. And so that was leading to a much more efficient form of portfolio construction, so people could actually have portfolios that were much more efficient. And so, you know, you could argue that maybe there needs to be a little bit more financial activity engendered by that ability to go from, you know, let's say I'm a bank and I am very good at originating certain kinds of loans. Now, in the old days, that's the kind of loans I would hold on my balance sheet. That meant I would not have an optimal portfolio from an investment perspective. Now we're in a bit brave new world where with derivatives and credit default swaps and all these things that I can lay off that risk and construct a different portfolio, you can sort of see that might have some benefit. I did note it myself.
Okay.
What about, thank you for that. You know, again, I mean, you mentioned this is sort of covered by your your first level causes that also run into the lessons learned. But generally, you know, this is on the sheet. Are financial crises inevitable? Can they be prevented? Do you think we've learned? What have we learned, if anything, to try to prevent another one in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my view on this is that, you know, inevitable, obviously, because do we really think for the fullness of time that there will never be another financial crisis? I would hesitate to say that. I think it's really more about trying to reduce the frequency and reduce the severity when they do in fact occur. You know, there are always inevitably going to be periods of over-optimism, financial, there's obviously going to always be areas where people have beliefs that turn out to be inappropriate, and when those beliefs are contradicted by experience, they're going to react in ways that are going to have financial consequences. But, you know, if we have a financial system where a lot more transparency, better incentives, more capital, bigger liquidity buffers, better resolution regime, then I think that when you have some sort of, you know, realization that something that people thought was a self-evident truth is actually wrong, like, for example, in my CDO example, that the correlations aren't zero, they're actually pretty high, that won't lead to such a large financial shock that you'll necessarily have a crisis, or if the crisis occurs, it will be a garden variety crisis, rather than a biggest crisis in the last 50 years crisis, which is what we actually experienced. So I think we can do a lot to make the crises less, financial shocks will occur, but we can reduce the probability that they'll turn into crises, and then when they do turn into crises, have them be more small potato in terms of their size.
Mm-hmm. And somewhat of a similar and related question, benefit of hindsight. What, if anything, do you think the New York Fed could have done better?
Well, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, it'd been nice to have identified all these potential issues, ahead of time, and raised the alarms and been effective in generating a, strong regulatory response. But, remember, a lot of this, was happening outside of our regulatory purview. So I think that, maybe that's not very realistic, but
right.
Obviously, benefit of hindsight, we would have liked to have done better.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, and I think that's just about everything I have. The last thing on the list that we sent you folks was just if you have any final thoughts that we haven't discussed.
No, I wouldn't be as presumptuous as I thought for
Okay. Well, Mr. Dudley, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it. It's been very helpful.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
President Dudley.